This is your DJ Ramsey. I come to you this Thursday and every Thursday from 4 to 6 p.m. for my regular show, Herbology, except that today I'm going to have an extra long show and I'll be with you until 6:55 p.m. That's almost 7 p.m. I'm glad you were able to join me on this wonderful Thursday afternoon here at Stanford, and I promise you a show full of music and delights, as well as amazing guests, because I will have three guests on today's show, and each will bring with him or her an amazing array of information and other cultural critiques that I'm sure our listeners will be delighted to hear. And in the first segment of my show today, I am so pleased and so excited, as you can tell from my voice, I hope, to welcome Dr. Lina Khatib, who is the program manager for the program on Arab Reform and Democracy. She is actually in the studio, and I'm delighted to have just welcomed her. We say in Arabic, Nawara al-studio, which means that the studio lit up naturally when Lina walked in. I'm looking forward to talking to her about several issues relating to the Arab world, as well as to the situation of women in Gulf countries and other things related to, I don't want to say feminist issues necessarily. We'll see where that will take us, but we will be doing it through a little bit of a satiric approach and a little bit of humor. So we'll be talking to Lina in the next 10 minutes. In the meantime, welcome to the show, DJ Ramsey, here on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM.
جبل وصحرا بحر وغابي طبيعة روح بلادي السجرة خضرة بنص الوادي وماي نضيفة مثل العيادي لو فيه ارجع بالزمان لنفس المكان وعيش روح الريف لو في بتنقل وين ما كان مثل النسر البلدان بالرياح العشوائية أيام ما الإنسان عش مثل الحيوان وكانت الحياة طبيعية أيام ما الإنسان كان متطور وفهمان قبل الثورة الصناعية الجبل وصحرا بحر وغابي طبيعة روح بلادي السجرة خضرة بنص الوادي وما ينضيفي مثل العادي
that was a group called Toot Ard and a song called Ruh Bladi. Toot Ard is, a new band, and they come from the Golan Heights, and they released this album that's filled of gems. I don't know how to describe it. It defies genres. It sounds like almost like reggae meets Arabic music, meets Western and Eastern beats fused together. It is really beyond description. And Toot Ard, Ruh Bladi, began the Arabology show here on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM, giving me time to welcome my wonderful guest today, none other than Lina Khatib, who is here at KZSU. Lina, we say in Arabic, Ahlan wa sahlan wa nawarti al studio.
Shukran, Ahlan Fik.
And that translation is the thank you and
welcome back to you.
Thank you. And it's actually a welcome back to you because, Lina, one of the many, many things that you've done is you were involved in broadcasting and you were involved in radio, in the radio industry, let's say, in Lebanon.
Yes, absolutely. I actually started my career in radio broadcasting back in 1987.
Wow, in Beirut?
Yes, in Beirut. And at the time, radio wasn't digital, so your studio looks super fascinating.
Does it? Yeah. Well, thank you. I say that because I know that you and I have met several times and talked about such things as the radio and other things going on at Stanford. But to our listeners who may not exactly know our Lebanese-to-Lebanese friendship that's been forming over the past few months, let me say that Lina Al-Khatib is a co-founder and program manager of the Program on Arab Reform and Democracy at the Center of Democracy Development and the Rule of Law at Stanford. She joined Stanford in 2010 from the University of London, where she was an associate professor. Her research is firmly interdisciplinary and focuses on the intersections of politics, media, and social factors in relation to the politics of the Middle East. Quite an impressive resume, Lina. Can we maybe start at the beginning and maybe we'll start with a little bit of a bio in terms of, being Lebanese. You were born and raised in Lebanon.
Yes, I was born and raised in Lebanon. And as I've just said, I started my career in radio broadcasting. I worked in radio for 11 years.
Wow.
And I really enjoyed it, except that the more I did it in Lebanon, the more I realized that I actually wanted to write about the media and the role of the media in politics and
nice.
How it influences society or interacts with society. And that's when I made the jump into academia. But I've remained firmly connected with the broadcasting world.
I can see you're feeling right at home here at
the
studio.
Oh, yes, I miss it.
You're like it's like riding a bike or something. No, because here, part of the Arabology show, what we try to do is to present cultural productions coming from, what I loosely call the Middle East, but really the Arabic-speaking world here, through music, through humor. And that's really one of the reasons that I've been looking forward to interviewing you today or to talking with you today. And that is because something pretty big is going on campus, and that has to do with the Arab Satire Night.
Oh, yes, the Arab Satire Night. See, the Arab Spring has, I think, brought world attention to satire in the Arab world, which is already a huge deal, but not many people perhaps outside the region know about it. But if anybody was watching closely Tahrir Square in Cairo last year, mm-hmm. they would have seen the many jokes that people carried on placards about mm-hmm. Mubarak, about the situation. And then there are, of course, sadder incidents to cite, like the Syrian cartoonist Ali Farzad, whose arms were broken by the Syrian regime last year because he's a prominent cartoonist and was drawing these cartoons that criticized the Syrian regime. So, good stories, bad stories, but at the heart of it, satire is a big deal in the Arab world. It's used to comment on politics. It's used to make fun of economic issues, social issues. And we thought, me and a group of people, including my colleague Ahmed Bin Shamsi, who's from Morocco, who's a visiting scholar at Stanford, why not organize an Arab Satire Night at Stanford?
Wow. Wow.
So now we're asking everybody who has mainly visually based material that deals with satire in the region to send us their videos, send us their photographs, send us the cartoons, and we'd like to showcase this for a night at Stanford.
Yeah, because I guess the date for the night isn't firmly planted yet, but...
It'll be sometime in April, hopefully. We haven't yet firmed up the exact date, but we will let everybody know.
So for our listeners at Stanford, you know, mainly students and other people interested in this, is there a contact person to contact about, you know, perhaps submitting the stuff or the material that we are discussing?
Yes, absolutely. They just need to email Ahmed bin Shamsi, who is in charge of this event, and he's happy for his email to be broadcast to everyone around the globe.
Okay.
It's benshamsi@stanford.edu. That's benchemsi @stanford.edu. So please do email Ahmed. He'll be happy to hear from anybody who's interested and has got good stuff. And we'd like to get as much representation from different Arab countries as possible.
Mm-hmm. So you're not necessarily limiting this to Egypt and Tunisia?
No, and not even to countries undergoing democratic transition and revolutions either. Because as I said, satire is a big deal across the region. And you'd be surprised how much satire exists even in countries that we consider to be ultra-conservative, like, say, Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, and I want to get back to that point, but in terms of the actual material to be submitted, are we talking about material in Arabic, and then you're going to sort of showcase it with a translation, or is this something that presupposes some knowledge of the Arabic language?
Well, actually, one thing we would like to do is solicit material in English, in Arabic. The material that needs translation, we've got already someone volunteering to translate the material for us. And we'd like people to introduce the clips they send us. So why don't you all show up when we have the Arab Satire Night and introduce the videos? Just tell us a bit about the context, because not everybody necessarily in the audience will know the nuances of the jokes. So we'd like to explain that too.
Absolutely. And with your permission, I'd also would like to sort of promote the event on my blog.
That
way people
great.
Listening to the show can always check my blog for the latest information on the day and the locations. Is there a deadline for the submission of this material?
Oh, yeah. We've put the first deadline as February 26th, so that's
coming up
in 3 days.
Okay.
So anybody out there who's got a favorite YouTube video of something, please do send it to Ahmed as soon as possible.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so I'm glad you were able to make the show today, because the deadline is coming up, and we certainly look forward to this, because I think, you know, at first I have to admit to you, Lina, that, you know, when I mentioned this Arab Satire Night, some of the people I spoke to, not necessarily just at Stanford, were talking about, well, this is a very serious revolution and people are putting their lives, you know, at risk, and here you are sort of poking fun at it. And I said, we're not, you know, necessarily, the point isn't to poke fun at it, but to show how humor, and through humor can be a survival tool, and humor can actually be as poignant as you know, words of wisdom delivered in a, you know, very philosophical way. And so the role of humor in the Egyptian uprising and in the Tunisian, you know, uprising is something that a lot of Americans don't really understand. We kind of see it as like, well, this is the Egyptian, what we call khifed dam, this kind of joie de vivre that the Egyptian people seem to have, and which translated into the revolution. Many of the signs you mentioned, you know, criticizing the Mubarak regime at the time were actually hilarious in
a way.
Oh,
yeah. I remember one person carrying a placard that says, "Go already, my arm hurts."
See, that's exactly what I mean. It's very powerful. I mean, it's funny and it's humorous, but it says a lot, because it's like it shows a people that have had enough and are physically maybe drained. And so that's part of what I think we're trying to do with this Arab Satire Night. We're not in any way trying to belittle the sacrifices that have been, that are an integral part of this kind of movement.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm glad you have highlighted these issues. Absolutely. Humor has been a survival technique. It's been a lobbying technique. It's been a critique of politics. It has played so many important roles. And just because it's, you know, something lighthearted doesn't mean that it's actually also serious at the same time.
Yeah. And so what about, you know, this idea of poking fun at politicians, you know, something that maybe in America we're kind of, we take for granted that you can, you know, draw a caricature of Obama and say something, and, you know, it's still considered freedom of speech, at least technically. And so is that still sort of difficult to do in countries like Egypt or Tunisia, and also perhaps in Lebanon? How's the sentiment over there in terms of expressing oneself maybe through humor, but making a political statement that way?
I think it's alive and well. And the interesting thing is that despite all the crackdowns that the previous regimes in, say, Egypt or Tunisia had done on this kind of expression, satirists were doing it anyway. Mm-hmm. And when they couldn't do it, say, in a newspaper, they would do it online. They mm-hmm. would draw their cartoons and disseminate them on a blog. Mm-hmm. Even contemporary artists in Egypt, I remember a very interesting artist called Maha Ma'moun, who composed these very interesting photographs that referenced Mubarak. For example, one of them simply had an extreme close-up of Mubarak's lips, and she she created this photograph with Mubarak's lips on billboards overlooking Cairo.
Wow.
It was a very arresting image, I have to say. And she did that, and she exhibited these things in Cairo at the time, under the Mubarak regime.
And it was received with humor? It was received... I mean, she wasn't
Yeah, she survived. She didn't... witness any kind of intimidation or anything. And that's interesting because at the time, a lot of these governments sometimes allowed this kind of humor to happen because they thought that it would be an outlet for people to express themselves without really threatening the regime. Mm-hmm. But then what we saw in the revolutions, of course, is these two things coming together. The mm-hmm. humor became a real political tool.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's one of the many aspects of these uprisings and these revolutions that go unnoticed, especially if you don't speak Arabic. I mean, you know, watching CNN and seeing these signs, people are wondering, well, you know, what are they saying? Are they saying down with the system? Well, yeah, there were, of course, Ashab Yurid Iskalt al-Nizam, but at the same time, it was many of them were humorous. And so when I was laughing at some of these images on CNN or on Al Jazeera, you know, in English, my American friends who didn't speak Arabic were saying that it was, you know, extremely insensitive of me. Mm. I said, but I'm laughing, you know, with what they're doing. Their intention is to make you laugh and through laughter to create this political.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you can laugh at yourself. Or you can laugh at your bad leaders, I suppose. And mainly this is what was going on during the revolutions. People used to laugh at their situation, the economic kind of crises, etc., as a coping mechanism. But during the revolutions, the humor changed. People were laughing at their leaders and doing it directly for the very first time. So the people like Maha Ma'moun, who used to kind of do it in, let's say, elitist contemporary art circles, or the people who used to do it in underground activist circles, these came to the fore. And just look at the graffiti scene in Cairo today. Mm, Not many people perhaps know about it, but please, anyone who's listening, look up Genzir, look up Sat Panda, look up Etanin. These are graffiti artists who are now, you know, just having their drawings and paintings all over the walls in Cairo. It's really amazing.
Wow. And so this is maybe the kind of visual art that we're talking about that could be submitted possibly
to the Satire Night.
And in terms of Lebanon, because, you know, that is my birthplace, and I've always sort of retained a very, very close connection, at least emotionally, with my childhood in Beirut. Is there such a thing as Lebanese humor that can be different from Egyptian humor, and how far do Lebanese go in terms of being able to criticize their government?
Oh, the Lebanese have had a very easy ride on that front for quite a long time. Because I think in Lebanon, there is no authoritarian government like what, you know, we see now in Syria or what we saw before in Libya, etc. So it's actually a very developed culture in terms of songs, in terms of jokes, in terms of TV shows. So, for example, there's a show called Duma Katir, which is based basically using puppets to make fun of the news of the day. So they have puppets of various politicians singing silly songs. And this is on TV, on mainstream TV, almost every night in Lebanon. Wow. You have someone like Ziad Rahbani, who is a prominent musician, very talented, and has some of the most popular political satire songs that are listened to across the Arab world, not just in Lebanon.
And so how would you address this question that I always get? Well, how come, you know, in other countries there's been these uprisings, but in Lebanon people sort of seem to be going on with their lives? Do we say that it's because they've always been able to get away with criticizing the politicians more, or is it that there is a sort of general sentiment of nonchalance?
Well, I think it's not just these two things. I think it's more complicated than that, unfortunately. But I think the fact that they are able to get away with a lot, even if it's not sanctioned in the law, mm-hmm. explains the lack of activism in Lebanon at the extent that we're seeing in other places.
You're
in
saying
the region.
The lack of activism.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's not indicative that there's so much activism that led to them being able to get this position of enunciation, this kind of position where you're able to do that. This was sort of not fought for as
not as much as say for example in Egypt. Sheikh Imam, who is, if anybody doesn't know who this person is, he was one of the leading political satire musicians, singers, composers in Egypt. And he composed a lot of his anti-regime and anti-occupation at the time of the British occupation in Egypt. He composed a lot of his songs in jail.
Wow.
And so, for example, he had to fight a lot for his humor. But in Lebanon, it's a different context. And I think, to go back to your point about how humor differs in different places.
Yeah, or
the
if
context,
it does.
I mean, definitely it does. Every country in the region has its own flavor, has its own cultural and political and historical context that influences the kind of humor that we see.
Yeah. And so this brings me sort of to the next question, because you had kind of mentioned that at the beginning of our talk here today, and that is the situation in Saudi Arabia and sort of the humor maybe that's out there. You know, we talked about this little video clip that's getting a lot of attention on the internet, these days, by Go Remy.
Oh, yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, he is an Arab American, actually from Virginia, but he creates these humorous videos in English on his YouTube channel. It's Go Remy, if anybody wants to look it up. Uh-huh. And my favorite song by him is called Opposites Attract. And it's a song that's meant to critique how women do not have the right to vote in Saudi Arabia.
And you see the humor. I mean, I watched the video. I have to say, you know, I don't want to say, I mean, it's deliberately offensive. Maybe I'm safe in saying that. But in some ways, does it discard some of the local issues in Saudi Arabia, where it's not simply a matter of women cannot drive or women cannot vote because it's a purely patriarchal system, because there's been these sort of critiques about, well, if a woman, let's talk about driving, for example, because then I'll get to voting in a second, but in terms of, you know, the media is now talking about Saudi Arabian women having the right to drive, and, you know, my initial reaction was, well, of course they should be able to drive. Why is there any problem going on? And then I spoke with some very sort of learned Saudi Arabian women. They were saying, well, it's not as easy as that, because by driving, it puts you in certain situations, like in a car accident or in a kind of situation where you might have to do something that you feel is traditionally, haram or wrong or whatever. How do you address that? I mean, in terms of, poking fun at it as if we were doing it through Western eyes.
Well, okay, poking fun at something is not necessarily also presenting the solution. Mm-hmm. Very often, humor is only there to highlight an issue. It's not necessarily there to tell you how to solve it. Mm. And so we shouldn't also give it too much responsibility. Yeah. I think Go Remy is simply saying, this is an issue and I want you to pay attention to it. He's not suggesting any Western or non-Western way of sorting this problem. I think the real solution will come from the ground, from Saudi Arabia, from the women themselves who are already launching these campaigns. Mm-hmm. For example, with driving, they are launching campaigns to try to drive. They are simply doing it anyway.
Right. And so you're saying it's not necessarily a Western-fueled kind of feminism, for lack of another word. It's sort of, yeah, because I think that is one point that I was made aware of time and time again in talking about this issue with women from Saudi Arabia and some men from Saudi Arabia, is the fact that you cannot just throw tradition aside and say, well, it's a woman can drive in America, that's no problem, so why should she be able to drive in Saudi Arabia? Because there is sort of a whole canon of traditions and
laws. Oh, absolutely. I mean, here we're talking about a very sensitive issue, which is the balance between exceptionalism and universalism. And I think we should not let exceptionalism blind us to something called universal human rights. Mm-hmm. And I think for a long time, a lot of, let's put it simply, bad stuff in the world was happening because people thought, oh, maybe this has been sanctioned by tradition and we should leave it alone. Whereas I think if we think of universalism in terms of human rights, the rights of the individual, whether a man or a woman, we're talking about equality. Mm-hmm. If we think about it that way, then, we can look at other places in the world, such as Japan, which has managed beautifully to merge modernity and tradition. Nice. So they do not necessarily contradict.
Absolutely. Lina Al-Khatib, time passes so quickly with you, and I know that you have quite a few things on your calendar today, but I did want to get to some of the things you've been doing at Stanford, and one of them is this Arabic table, and another is your involvement, of course, with as program manager for the program on Arab reform and democracy. Can you tell us a little bit about that, your work here at Stanford?
Yes, absolutely. I joined Stanford just over 2 years ago, and I run a very multidisciplinary program called Program on Arab Reform and Democracy. It's based at CDDRL, which is the Center on Democracy Development and the Rule of Law. And what we do is research mostly, I would say, anything related to democracy and political and economic reform in the Arab world. We have several research projects. We have an annual conference. In fact, our next conference is taking place on April 26 and 27, and it'll deal with the impact of democratic transition on development in the Arab world. So we do a lot of activities, both on campus and off campus. We have, for example, a project going on now in Yemen, where all the researchers are Yemeni and in Yemen, talking about how we can resolve the kind of political crisis in Yemen and lead to reform. We have projects on social entrepreneurship, projects on Lebanon and reforming the political system there. So it's a very diverse program. And as a result of this program, I started engaging with the community at Stanford that's interested in Arab studies in general. And we found that there's a gap, because at the end of the day, my program only deals with democracy and reform. That's what it's there for, which is fine. But Stanford needs more than this when it comes to engaging with the Arab world. Mm-hmm. And that's why a group of people from Stanford, mainly graduate students, we all decided to set up something called the Arab Studies Table at Stanford, which is a collective. It's a networking opportunity. It's a group of people who can come together, engage with outside speakers, engaged with just each other and discuss issues related to the Arab world, whether we're talking arts, whether we're talking history, politics, anything really related to Arab studies. And we hope that this will be the start of larger engagement at Stanford in Arab studies in general.
Absolutely. Has there been sort of a good response or turnout for these kind of Arabic tables?
Oh, absolutely. We try to have our events almost every month. And we've had only three so far because we haven't existed for long. And the response has been amazing. We had an event on Tunisia where a lot of people came to discuss the elections that took place back in November. We had an event on Egypt that was extremely well attended. And we only last week had an event on Syria where we had an outside speaker called Bassam Haddad who was discussing both the economic and political situation in Syria.
Absolutely.
So, yes, it's been great, and we hope we can go further.
And so for further information on the Arabic table, is the can I refer people to a website?
If they actually visit the website of the program I run, which is Arab Reform and Democracy, you'll get a link to the Arab Studies table at Stanford.
And this is open to anybody sort of interested in or invested in something to do with Arabic studies?
Oh, yes. This is open to anybody at Stanford or affiliated with Stanford who's interested in Arab world stuff, no matter what discipline, what field, what political leanings you come from. We're open to engage with everybody. And because this is, we like to call it a grassroots movement, you don't need to kind of propose an event to someone for approval before you do it. So if you want to see something happen on the Arab world at Stanford and you're a member of the table, you can go ahead and just do it.
Lina Al-Khatib, you are an amazing speaker. And as you were speaking, I was thinking of the amazing number of books and publications you've had here. So in parting, let me ask you, you know, what's on the horizon? What's next for Lina Al-Khatib in terms of maybe publications? What are you working on currently? Anything you'd like to share with our listeners?
Oh, yes. Listeners, buy my book when it comes out in September.
Actually, what book is that?
Well, I have a book coming up in September. It's called Image Politics in the Middle East. The subtitle is The Role of the Visual in Political Struggle. Wow. So in this book, I cover how images have been a very crucial component of political struggle, mainly between states and activists and citizens in the region. And I look at it from a kind of historical perspective from 2005 until today. And I had a lot of fun doing research for this book in places like Iran, Lebanon, Syria, and other places. And this is my latest project.
Wow, amazing. Because, you know, just looking at your, you know, bibliography here, looking at some of what you've published in terms of record of publications, I mean, there's always this emphasis on the visual. And that's exactly what we're trying to do now through the Arabic satire, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Sort of, you know, so you're encouraged to submit this kind of visual media, whether it be caricatures or, you know, graffiti.
Or a music video. It could be anything.
Absolutely. Lina Al-Khatib, what a joy it is to have you in the studio today. I know you had several engagements. You made time for us here at KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. I'm delighted to have spoken with you, and I hope you'll come back again, time and time again, whenever you're in the area, and give a shout-out to our listeners here on the Arabology Show. And on a more friendly and intimate basis, I would like to congratulate you for choosing Ziad Rahbani Shabani song today. I was asking Lena, you know, what song she'd like to play in terms of, you know, a dedication to, well, from her. And she chose Ziad al-Rahbani. Now, to me, I immediately smiled and said, that's very apropos, considering we're talking about satire and humor and, you know, and Ziad al-Rahbani. But for our listeners who don't really know who he is, can you just give us sort of a very brief bio or who is he to, who is Ziad al-Rahbani?
Okay, Ziad al-Rahbani is now, I would say, in his 50s. He is a very talented musician, playwright, and singer in Lebanon. He is the son of the famous Fairuz.
Not my favorite singer of all time,
I have to say. Oh, I guess a lot of people would agree with you in Lebanon and outside. So Ziad al-Rahbani has made a mark on kind of political theater in Lebanon, as well as music that addresses social, economic, and political issues. Mm-hmm. So he sees himself as a committed artist, although he also has a lot of frivolous music that's absolutely delightful to listen to. So not everything he does is satire, but he does a lot of satire.
Yeah, I mean, he's been around since, you know, the 70s.
Oh, absolutely. And in the 70s, he was mainly famous for musical theater, where he created a number of plays, some of which are seen now as having, in a way, predicted the Lebanese civil war.
Wow.
So he has a sharp eye for what is going on in society, and he uses art to comment on it.
Right. And although he's, you know, sometimes criticized for this kind of frivolous music, which some people say may just be his, you know, attempt to, you know, I don't know. He seems like he's kind of eccentric in the way he presents himself, but still he's a musical genius, and that sort of takes after his late father, who was Fairuz's husband and who wrote some of her most of her music. And so Ziad al-Rahbani is also now writing for Fairuz.
Oh, yeah.
But the song that I thought, you know, would be more fun today would be the song that, you know, that Lena didn't actually choose, but when she said Ziad al-Rahbani, I said, well, have you heard of
Wallat Kteer? I'm happy with anything as long as it's Ziad al-Rahbani.
Well, let's see if you're going to like this. It's called Wallat Kteer. And it's about smoking too much. And it's really sort of a commentary, I think, on, you know, overdoing things and being completely apolitical to a degree where you're not caring about what's going on around you. And, of course, I think the driving humor in it is to say that, you know, we got to also wake up and participate in what's going on around us. The song is called Wallat Kteer. It's actually written by Ziad al-Rahbani, who joins with the main singer Salma in the song. I hope you'll enjoy it, Lena. And I will say that I chose the song so that if there's any kind of criticism
Ramzi
about the smoking, I'm not. Lena is in no way advising anybody.
Smoker.
No, nor is she advising anybody to smoke anything out there. But the song is immediately likable. I think our listeners will like it. And would you like to dedicate this to anybody out there, Lena? And you know, we have listeners in Lebanon right now listening through kcsulive.stanford.edu. We've got a lot of listeners who tune in every week and write and tune into the show. Any kind of marhabas, salutations you care to put out there?
I would say marhaba mama.
So it's mama is listening.
Mama used to listen to my radio show when I worked in Lebanon every single Monday.
Really?
And when you consider that at one point I presented a heavy metal music show. Now that's dedication
and
on
she
Mama's
tuned
part.
In, and
oh
she
yeah!
Didn't turn it
oh, she listened to death metal every Monday.
Wow! That is true love, and that's a really true and a great mother, and a very hip one. I would say.
She's more hip than I am.
She's probably listening to hip hop as we speak. Right
she's
now.
Way ahead.
Well, marhaba. So your family still is in Lebanon. Well, we'll say marhaba to everybody out there. And Lena, thank you so much for joining me today on the Arabology
Show. Thank you, Ramzi.
Show.
It's been an absolute delight.
Thank you, and I hope to see you soon at one of the many events we discussed here. Lena Al-Khatib was my guest for the first part of Arabology here on KZSU 90.1 FM, Stanford. And let's go right to the song that we talked about by Ziad al-Rahbani called Wallat Kteer here on the Arabology Show.
فكرك قوي يا فهلاوي منك بيها القوية
عم بحكي رد علي بس تحكي تطلع فيي
إذا فكرك قوي يا فهلاوي منك بيها القوية ولا يوما راح بتصير
Support for the KZSU Silent Disco in January provided by Sunset Promotions, promoting niche music and art through parties and festivals. On December 31st at 8 p.m. at the Concourse Exhibition Center, Sunset Promotions presents Sea of Dreams New Year's Eve, an 18-plus event featuring Santi Gold, ISAM, Beats and Teak, and more. SunsetPromotions.com.
The show is Arabology, and this is your DJ Ramsey with you this Thursday and every Thursday here on KZSU Stanford, 94.1 FM. I wanted to thank my special guest, Lina Khatib, for gracing the studio today and speaking to us about so many issues relating to the Arab Spring and humor that takes place or is often taking place within these very serious revolutions. Lina Khatib was my guest for the first segment of Arabology, and we segued from that into a song by none other than Ziad Rahbani with the vocals of Selma. The song was called Wallati Ktir, and that means you lit up a lot, and by that they mean, well, probably cigarettes. Not a call for anybody to smoke out there, certainly not, but sort of a poking humor at, some Lebanese citizens who sort of do nothing but sit there and smoke all day. And I guess that would be my interpretation of the song Wallati Ktir by Ziad Rahbani. Every year, the Second Harvest Food Bank of Santa Clara and San Mateo counties distributes nearly 30 million pounds of food to people in need right here in our community. But they can't do it without your help. To find out how to contribute to their programs, volunteer your time, or start your own food drive, call the Second Harvest Food Bank at 866-234-3663 or visit www.2secondharvest.net. That's www.2ndharvest.net. One last time, that's www.secondharvest.net. The show is Arabology. I'm your DJ Ramsey, and I'll be with you tonight, actually, for this evening, all the way to 5:55 p.m. And, of course, at 5:55 p.m. will be time for Stanford Sports with women's basketball versus Colorado, and that will follow my show from 5:55 p.m. until 8 p.m. this evening. I hope you've enjoyed the conversation I had with Lina Khatib today, as well as the song I played. We will be actually interviewing two other very interesting people here on the Arabology show this evening, and they are both students of Arabic here at Stanford who come with, amazing personalities and a wonderful take on Arabic music and Arabic video clips that sort of are all over Arabic TV these days. We'll be discussing these kind of images as well as what constitutes new Arabic music with both of these students later on in the show. In the meantime, let's all sort of kick back and let the hip-hop take over for a little bit. Well, Arabic hip-hop, yes, indeed. This is going to be a highly addictive song. I warn you out there. It is called Islahat, and it's Mido Zahir, and also produced, I believe, by Zaid Hamdan. So, talking about the Arab Spring, talking about uprisings and revolutions. Here is a song, and within that spirit, that talks about Islahat. Islahat in Arabic means reparations and repairs and reformations. So let's let the music take over and speak on its own.
إصلاحات ويزي كمان إشفاء أسري المومياوات ومياوات هات الحوادث الأحادث في البلاد النقود تعجت لشوطة وصبره داب في الملاحات والنبي سخت العيال نصيبها مال زي البنات وان نادية بريزة وقعت وان فاطمة شرب رجعت وان شكري وكالة قرر يشتغل في الممنوعات النقود تعجت لشوطة وصبره داب في الملاحات والنبي سخط العيال نصيبها مال زي البنات وان نادية بريزة وقعت وان فاطمة شرب رجعت وان شكري وكالة قرر يشتغل في الممنوعات شرك هو شري وان جوعك قط بري وان شرك هو شري وان جوعك قط بري بس بعد التعري يتقيك برد الحاجات حلفة بر العمر مر وما انتهيتش المسألة اللي براح لغز داير عالولا يا حلفة بر العمر مر وما انتهيتش المسألة الاستراح واللي براح لغز داير عالولا وسين وجيم وشطان رجيم بيجري في بلاد الخلا وسين وجيم وشطان رجيم بيجري في بلاد الخلا من قلت صوت تبقى بنموت وما انتهيتش المسألة نقول بصوت تبقى بنموت وما انتهيتش المسألة انتهيتش المسألة
Every 2 seconds, someone in the U.S. needs blood. The Stanford Blood Center supplies patients with more than 100,000 blood components per year to help save lives. They rely on community donors like you to accomplish their mission of making sure blood is there when it's needed.
All healthy, eligible individuals are invited to donate. For more information, call the Stanford Blood Center directly at 650-723-7831 or just visit bloodcenter.stanford.edu.
This show is Arabology, and I'm your DJ Ramsey. It is coming up to 5 p.m. here on KZSU Stanford, 90.1 FM. And I still have, well, around 2 hours to go with you this evening here on the weekly Arabology show. I'm glad to welcome you this Thursday and every Thursday for this kind of, discussion and music show that centers on the Arabic-speaking world and on highlighting and showcasing some of the cultural productions that come from the Arabic-speaking world. And as I say that, I noticed that the two guests that I hinted about earlier in the show are actually here at KZSU. None other than Omar and Alina have arrived. We'll be speaking to them shortly about, well, many things, including their experience of learning Arabic here at Stanford. And I believe that each one of these fine young people will be dedicating a song to somebody that, has thus far been undisclosed. We'll be talking to Omar and Alina in the second part of the Arabology show here on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. In the meantime, let's give way to the music. And who better than the amazing Nancy Ajram and a song called Alfi Leila Wa Leila, that, of course, translates into 1001 Nights. That was the amazing Nancy Ajram and a song called Elfi Leila Wi Leila. And that song was taken from her album called Sahrat Tarab. And that's, of course, a live performance by the one and only Nancy Ajram. Thank you, Nancy, for that beautiful voice. And that leads me to my wonderful guests this amazing evening. Alina and Omar are in the bait. Ahlan wa sahlan.
Marhaba.
Hello, Ramzi.
And so for those of you who don't know Alina and Omar, the two people on earth who may not know you at Stanford, you are, of course, well, you used to be my students in my Arabic classes. You then went on to become, well, like family to me, I would say. And I'm saying this on the air, so you know I mean it.
You became like family to us, Ramzi.
Ramzi.
Shukran, shukran. Alina and Omar, you're both undergraduate students here at Stanford. And my first question to you has to be, why did you decide to take Arabic at this stage in your lives? Maybe that will require you to talk a little bit about your background, because both of you are what we consider in a way to be heritage students. You did not come into the Arabic classroom with zero knowledge of Arabic, but you certainly weren't ready to delve into the grammar and complexity of the language. So maybe we'll start with Alina here, and she can tell us a little bit about her choices and what led her to take Arabic here at Stanford.
So I grew up Muslim, so I actually learned to read and write Arabic before I even learned to read English. So I was 3 years old and was learning Alif Bay, but I had no idea what I was reading. I mean, I grew up learning Arabic so that I could read the Quran, but I didn't understand any of it. And so when I got to Stanford, I was really excited because I saw that I could take Arabic for the first time. So the first week of Arabic was easy because I already knew the letters, but I struggled a little bit because I learned kind of the Urdu pronunciation of everything. Mm. So I used to pronounce my ba's and my ta's completely wrong. But I was really interested in learning Arabic, partly because I wanted to learn the Quran, and partly because I already knew how to read it, so it was kind of nice to actually learn what I was reading.
Wow. And so you kind of knew the alphabet and the letters before you started in Arabic, and we're more familiar with the Fusha Arabic, what we call classical Arabic, Alina. What about colloquial Arabic? Did that come as a complete shock to you?
I knew a couple of colloquial words. I mean, I have friends that are from Jordan and Lebanon and Syria, Egypt, and so I would hear them talking, Yalla Habibi, Shrey Shrey.
Oh,
so,
wow.
So that was all I picked up. And then we would learn in class Amiya, and it was just completely over my head.
Wow, yeah. Not the case for Omar Zain at all. In fact, you're almost the opposite, Omar, where you knew colloquial and had to work on sort of perfecting your classical Arabic.
Yeah, Ramzi, I'm originally Tunisian, but I spent most of my life in America. So while I had no problem picking up colloquial from my parents and from visiting Tunisia during the summer, it was always a completely different story for Fusha. You know, I took a few classes, maybe when I from first to third grade, and I never really liked it much, never put much effort into it. But coming to Stanford was a great way to pick that up again. And I thought everyone was telling me that Arabic is extremely well taught here. Everyone was saying only positive things about all of the lectures, and it was a great way for me to get back in touch with that Arabic culture, because there's such a cultural aspect to the class also, and I enjoyed that very much.
Absolutely. And I remember, Omar, that one of the things that happened while you were my student was, of course, the Tunisian uprising. I mean, we started the quarter with, you know, Tunis being Tunisia being Tunisia, and then it turned into a whole other thing, and you were here in the Arabic classes almost on a daily basis watching this uprising happen in Tunis right in front of your very eyes, but not being there physically. How was that for you, Omar, as somebody who is, you know, Tunisian background, of a Tunisian background?
Oh, I was freaking out the whole time. It was extremely difficult, partly because, You are. I mean, my mother was in Tunisia at the time. She was supposed to leave, but all the flights were grounded while the revolution was happening. And my whole family was there, and everybody. It was a period of great turmoil and great distress that we're not used to in Tunisia. And as Tunisians, we're used to having a pretty calm state. But of course, we're all very supportive of the revolution, and we're very glad it happened. But following it from Stanford was particularly difficult. On one hand, because of the turmoil that's going on, and because of the fear you have for your family, and on the other hand, because to a large extent I felt that Tunisia was maybe not getting all of the attention that it deserved when it was only Tunisia that went through the uprising. Not much attention was devoted to it at all. When Egypt came into the mix, a lot more people started talking about the Arab Spring and the Jasmine Revolution. But one of the things that I was most appreciative of is. I remember in Arabic class, you brought up the Tunisian Revolution very early as it was happening. And that was like a source of respite for me, that people were paying attention to this, that people were following this.
Yeah. Did you feel a sense of complete shock or surprise? Or was this something that you felt had long been in the making and had kind of been, on the horizon? Did this completely catch you by surprise, Omar?
It was an extremely pleasant surprise. I mean, a big part of visiting Tunisia for me was always arguing with aunts, uncles, cousins, grandparents about how there's no democracy and no freedom in Tunisia, and nobody seemed to care.
No.
And
yeah.
So literally what happened is within this span of 2-3 weeks, all of a sudden it seemed like everybody cared.
Right.
And we actually had our dictator overthrown, even though he was in place for 23 years. Mm-hmm. And I mean, the summer before this revolution, you couldn't even speak his name in the streets for fear of somebody hearing you and somebody suspecting that you might be saying something bad about the regime. So it was a complete shock, but a very pleasant surprise in hindsight.
Absolutely. And look what you guys started. I mean, I think if it weren't for that, I don't know how much of we would have seen in terms of Egypt and other countries. This brings me to Alina. And Alina, your reaction to all this. I mean, you took Arabic well before the Arab Spring. So you weren't one of those students who decided to jump on the bandwagon in the last minute. You were devoted to the language. But how much of a surprise did the Arab Spring come to you, and how do you feel about it as someone who represents, you know, Muslim Americans at Stanford? Whether you know you're doing so directly or indirectly, you are sort of who you are, and proud of who you are. What is your take on this whole uprising and Arab Spring?
So I want to kind of reiterate what Omar said. I'd been taking Arabic, and I loved the cultural aspect of the class. We watched Nancy Hajram, Omar Diab. We learned Debka. We did so much. And so when the Arab Spring, when all of these uprisings occurred, I remember you teaching us some of the vocabulary, you teaching us, you know, what is revolution in Arabic. And so it was nice to see that integrated into our class. I remember you telling us, I mean, we did presentations, and
right,
I remember
right.
Someone did El General and talked about, you know, how his music reflected the revolution. So it was nice to be in a class where it wasn't just about the politics of the revolution, but about the actual people, and kind of having the chance to learn what was going on kind of language-wise, so that you could maybe read an article on Al Jazeera and maybe understand a couple of words. But as a Muslim, I think it was nice to see the Arab world and the Muslim world in a light other than just terrorism.
Absolutely.
It was nice to see kind of a group of people striving for democracy and that being respected by the Western world. I think the Time magazine cover was The Protester, and it had a picture of a protester from the Arab world, and it was nice to see that kind of coverage rather than just Osama bin Laden and rather than just terrorism. So as a Muslim student, I think it was nice to again see some values that were being shared, at least politically. It wasn't just about what is Muslim culture as it relates to democracy. It was about really just basic human rights.
Absolutely. And you mentioned El General, and I think maybe I saw a big smile go on Omar's face here. For people who don't know who he is, how would you describe him? I mean, this is somebody who's your generation, who's had quite a bit of an impact on the whole uprising.
Yeah, I was actually the person who gave the presentation on El General in the class.
I thought you were going to say, I was actually the, because he wasn't, you know, he was sort of hidden for a while.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you chose to kind of bring his name into the classroom, but by then he had already been sort of detained by the Tunisian, the government at the time, and then released because of his views and his songs. Can you just tell us, recap a little bit of that presentation? You don't have to do it in Arabic.
I mean, absolutely. I think El General deserves more credit than he's given most of the time, because his songs against the regime actually came out before the symbolic immolation of Bouazizi. You know, the man who set himself on fire and which started the whole revolution. His songs actually came out before then, and he was detained and everything even before then. So he really was a crucial part of setting the stage for this revolution early on. And he came out with some rap songs that were very, very explicitly critical of the regime, which is something that you don't often see. You might sometimes see some satire that barely gets through the censorship. But but you didn't really see such explicit critique, like the kind of critique that El General brought.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you're talking maybe about that song, Rais Le Bled, translates
as the emblematic song,
which our American listeners translates as
like President of the Country,
right? And sort of this imploring the President of the Country to see the dehumanization that was going on, the unemployment rate,
and really, really calling him out on all of the abuse that was going on.
Absolutely, Alina, you mentioned being Muslim American here in the U.S. at a time where, you know, one has to admit the media isn't necessarily doing a fair job of representing that. And so what is your experience in terms of being a Muslim American here? And more importantly, what are some of the groups on campus maybe that a Muslim American can join or be a part of, or even non-Muslim Americans who want to learn about Muslim Americans? Do you have any suggestions or any groups that you have found to be particularly useful?
I think you kind of led into that question. Muslim Student Awareness Network and the Islamic Society of Stanford University are actually in the process of doing IAS right now, which is the Islamic Awareness Series. And they kind of pick a topic each year that's something that I guess the non-Muslim world isn't really familiar with. I mean, we've done things like the Five Pillars of Islam. And so this year they picked revolutions in Islam, and they picked like the Arab Spring and things like that. And so they've had a couple of lectures. I think they have some events coming up. They had a talk last night with Abbas Khadim, and then they're going to have a talk, I think, on the 23rd. So
not today.
Today they have like an art show up in Old Union, and then on the 27th and the 3rd they're going to have some panels about the uprising in Syria.
So they've been pretty active, and sort of maybe trying to counterbalance some of the
negative
images. Alina, what do you say? How do you react when you do hear occasionally? I mean, we're in California, and we're pretty, I think, lucky to be living in the Bay Area, where people are a little bit more aware. But what do you do when you hear a comment like, "Well, you're Muslim, you must, be a submissive woman. You must not be able to have the freedom to." I mean, people assume all this stuff about you. How do you respond to this kind of, very limited thinking?
I think I've been very lucky. I mean, you mentioned I was born and raised in California, so I think I've been a little bit insulated as far as derogatory comments go. But I think especially being a Muslim woman, people are often surprised. I don't think I lead into any conversation with, "Hello, by the way, I'm Muslim. Most of the time, it's they get to know me, and then they find out that I'm Muslim. And sometimes people are surprised, I think. I mean, I don't wear hijab, for example, so I don't think I come off as a very typical Muslim woman. But I think the way to counter that is just example. I think people telling you you're submissive doesn't make you submissive. I think people telling you that you're expected to behave a certain way doesn't really force you to do that. Absolutely. I was very lucky. I have an older brother. I have actually 5 siblings. But my parents have been very...
Mashallah.
Yeah, my parents have been very, very fair, I would say. My brother was at Stanford, and I'm at Stanford now, too, so... I think they never really made any distinction that because he is male, his education is more important than mine. Nice. So I've been very lucky, I think. And I don't think anyone, after meeting me or seeing kind of the life that I lead, has the right to really assume that I'm submissive. So I think that's kind of how I've dealt with that.
And of course, I just pulled that out of a hat because that seems to be one of the things you hear a lot, especially regarding women. And that comes also with the fact of or the discourse that centers on the hijab. And of course, I think the kind of educational campaign that's been going on campus is to sort of look beyond the veil. Not to say, well, I mean, I think we all agree that it should be a choice and that you shouldn't be sort of forced to wear it if that's not what you believe in as a young Muslim woman. But the idea was this whole campaign that was going on around campus. I saw the t-shirts, and do you remember the logo? And it's not what's...
In your head,
it's what's in your head. Yes. And as you've seen those, I mean, that's exactly what it means, right? And so, Omar, you are also sort of dealing with issues, I'm sure, as a young, Muslim male in this post 9/11 era. How has your experience been? Do you find yourself sort of dealing with the kind of Islamophobia or comments that you'd rather do without?
Well, Ramzi, I can't really recall any specific explicit act of discrimination where a stranger will have discriminated against me because I look Arab or because I look Muslim. But what hurt me the most, I remember, in middle school and high school was when my closest friends would start making more and more jokes of a bit of a racist nature, and you'd really see what crushed me was like seeing them make more and more of these jokes, and then you could really feel that in the process of joking so much about it, they were maybe actually starting to believe to some degree everything that they, and so it was very disturbing to see this kind of Islamophobia creep up on people that I am so close to.
And it almost became permissible to have
jokes,
you know, that centered on that, ignoring the fact that, of course, most, if not, you know, all Muslim Americans that I know are peaceful and productive citizens of the U.S. who have the right to the civil rights that everybody else enjoys. Omar and Alina, time passes quickly with you guys. And not only when I used to teach you or the class would fly by, but also here in the studio. And I know that you guys have a lot to do here. It is on a Thursday night and it's a school night. But at the same time, I wanted to give you a chance to play some music here because the Arabology show is, after all, a music show. And I know that Omar chose a very special song for a special reason. So we'll have Omar say that, begin with his choice and dedicate it to whoever he wants. No censorship allowed here, Omar. And then we're going to move on to Alina, because Alina picked a good song as well.
Okay, so the song that I picked out is by an artist called Anwar Ibrahim. And one of the things that I've always liked the most about your shows is that, in a sense, you're kind of bringing instrumental music back. You know, you don't really hear much instrumental music on the radio waves in American pop culture, but in the Arab world, instrumental music is still very much part of the standard repertoire of music that your average Arab citizen will listen to. And so Anwar Ibrahim is a Tunisian oud player.
Wow.
The oud is some ancestor of the guitar. It looks pretty much like a guitar, except it's a bit more oval shaped.
Absolutely.
And he's in a trio with a clarinetist and a drummer. And the song is called Astrakhan Cafe.
So that's just the name of the cafe.
Yeah, apparently. And I'd like to dedicate it to my mother for all the evenings that we spent playing this song and trying to play it by ear on our own oud back home in Washington, D.C.
That is very sweet, Omar. And just for the sake of your old professor, do you want to make that dedication in Arabic so to show off your Arabic speaking skills? You know, do you want to make a hadiyah to your mother or an ehda to your mother or anybody else?
Absolutely. أريد أن أهدي الأغنية أسركان كافيه من أنور إبراهيم لأمي.
جميل جدا يا عمر. أنت تتكلم اللغة العربية بشكل ممتاز.
شكرا رمزي.
شكرا يا عمر. وعلينا علينا you chose a song by none other than Nancy Ajram. And for those two people on earth who don't know who Nancy Ajram is, well, at least in my world, who is she?
Nancy Ajram is amazing. She's جميلة جدا. She's beautiful. She's in Arab pop star. She's Lebanese, right?
Right, yes. Absolutely Lebanese.
Very Lebanese. And so she's, I would like to say she's the Britney Spears of the Arab world. Well, can I say that? Is that fair?
That's pretty fair, at least in the first part of her career, because she really did, you know, sort of imitate the West, but has since gone on to become, you know, a singer in her own right. Mm-hmm. You actually chose a song from early on in her career called Laun...
Launa yunuk, which means the color of your eyes.
The color of your eyes. Now, was there perchance a video clip that went with that?
This was the second video clip you showed us in first quarter Arabic, my freshman year. And I remember we were watching it and you told us. So basically, the premise of the video is that Nancy Ajram is getting married. She's in this beautiful gown. She's getting married. It's a beautiful, beautiful Arab wedding. She's actually the man that plays her husband was Mr. Lebanon, I think you told us. It was a very beautiful video.
Yes, he was a well-known, yes.
Symbol
of, I don't know, Lebanese masculinity, I guess. and so the song is about the color of your eyes. Do you ever know who directed that clip?
No.
Well, her name is Nadine Levaki, and she is a Lebanese you know, female director who has since gone on to make movies and has been doing movies actually all along. She has a brand new movie called Duhalla Lawain, translated and Et Maintenant On Va Où, or in English, Where Do We Go Now? And you're going to find the same kind of cinematography you saw in Nancy's clips on the big screen. This movie, you know, there was talk of an Oscar, you know, nomination for this movie. And so maybe what we should do, the three of us and all other interested students, is to go together and watch Wahalla Lawain as a tribute to Nancy Ajram and to the Arabic classes here at Stanford. Who would you like to dedicate the song to, Alina?
So a friend of mine actually just got engaged.
Ooh,
yeah, mabruk,
mabruk,
mabruk, mabruk.
That's Omar piping in, yes. you want to dedicate it to her?
Absolutely.
And her beloved, I guess.
And her beloved.
That's very sweet.
I hope their wedding is as beautiful as Nancy Ajram's in the video.
Oh, wow, yes, that is a beautiful wedding, though it's a little bit staged. I hope
yes.
It tends to be more spontaneous. Alina and Omar, it is a pleasure to have had you. Thank you for stopping by.
Oh, shukran ya Ramzi.
You guys did it on such a short notice.
Thank you so much, Ramzi. It was a pleasure being here.
Ahlan wa sahlan. Omar, I'm going to go right to your song by Anwar Ibrahim Trio called Astrakhan Cafe. And we'll go from that to Nancy Ajram. So as you guys depart from the studio, if you're listening to, you know, your iPods or the radio anywhere, you'll be able to hear your songs and say, well, I was just there. Shukran lakum for coming into the studio today here on the Arabology Show, coming to you from KZSU Stanford and 90.1 FM. It has been my pleasure to host you both, and I hope you feel free to come back whenever you feel nostalgia for Arabic music. Ahlan wa sahlan bikum. Okay, so we'll be taken over by the beautiful music in the next few minutes. I'll be back with you until 6:55 p.m. here on the Arabology Show, coming to you from KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM.